Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown, and the first of a two-part discussion with our very special guest, Sir Paul Tucker, we will be talking about the level of responsibility that has been delegated to central bankers. Sir Tucker is the author of Unelected Power, The Quest for Legitimacy in Central Banking and the Regulatory State, as well as a new book, Global Discord, Values and Power in a Fractured World Order. In this first episode, we will focus on Unelected Power, described as masterful by Danny Roderick and profoundly important by Larry Summers. The book charts how the extraordinary power of unelected central bankers and regulators needs to be structured and checked in the interest of democratic legitimacy. Now, a little background for those who may not be familiar with his work. Sir Tucker, knighted by Great Britain in 2014, is a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, a senior fellow at Harvard Center for European Studies, a governor of the Ditchley Foundation, a director of the Financial Volunteer Corps, a member of the advisory board for Yale's Program on Financial Stability, and president of the UK's National Institute for Economic and Social Research. Sir Tucker spent more than three decades in central banking, occupying senior positions in the international policymaking world. As deputy governor of the Bank of England from 2009 to 2013, he was at the front and center of efforts to contain the financial crisis and reshape the international regulatory framework for financial stability. Mervyn King, former governor of the Bank of England and good friend of the show, said of Sir Tucker, "Paul probably understands more about central banking than anyone else. He knows about every aspect of that arcane art, and now he is free to tell the rest of the world what happens behind those high walls." Sir Tucker, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's very good to be here.
Sir, so thank you so much for coming on the show today. We're grateful for you taking the time to join us. We have two episodes with you, and this one will center around Unelected Power, and it's the book's inquiry into the delegation of policymaking. You state in the book that the purpose of the book was to explore whether it is possible to find a place for technocratic independent agencies in our system of government without jeopardizing democratic legitimacy. You also ask, if vast chunks of policy are outsourced, could elected officials find themselves left with little more than tweeting and foreign policy? Now, I certainly recognize I'm in the minority here, but I quite like the idea of delegation to experts. If my elected officials here in the U.S. Were found with nothing more than tweeting and foreign policy, I would be utterly elated. I find it, at least here in the U.S., elected officials are precisely the last people you want deciding your fate. To be sure, I firmly believe in democracy, but I also believe there are subjects, central banking for one, which are just far too complicated to be understood by the typical congressperson or senator, and definitely far too complicated for them to carry out themselves. Now, having said that, I do agree that there should be some system or framework where that guides us when debating what tasks government should delegate to experts. So when we think about what we are to have our elected officials carry out themselves versus what tasks we need delegated to independent expert-led agencies, what are some of the things that we need to take into consideration? You say in the book that expertise cannot of itself provide the basic motivation for insulating policymaking from politics. So what are the factors that make regulation without representation a good thing, and when does it threaten democracy?
Well, it's a great question, of course, and I understand why you express frustration with elected officials and say, my goodness, maybe these unelected officials would do better. But dare I say, if you lived in such a world, you would probably quite quickly go off it, because you'd be relying, we'd all be relying on these unelected people like me, sticking to the job that they'd been given, rather than diverging into something else. And if they did, part of the country would say, fantastic, we really like the politics of that. And other people would say, hell, how do we get rid of these people? Can't we vote them out?
No, right.
You can't vote them out. The really important thing, one of the really important things about elected officials, whether under the American system of democracy or the British system of democracy or the French or whatever, is that we can get rid of them, and they know that. Now, I'm glad you alighted on this, because I do argue that expertise isn't enough to delegate. It's certainly necessary. I mean, the idea of delegating to people who aren't expert is slightly crazy, but it happens.
Right.
But if you delegated to just on the basis of expertise, it would be better to give them the role of advising in public. And then I'm not just talking about central banking now, but in general. You could delegate transport policy or environmental policy to people and independent experts, and they could advise in public, and some elected official could take the final decision. But all of the technical issues and how to weigh them would be in the public arena. I think the grounds for going a step further and letting the unelected person or people actually make the decision is where the politicians can't actually be relied upon to stick to their objectives. So now, picking up central banking in particular, so we promise to keep inflation low. Well, it's just not going to be in the interests of elected officials to keep inflation low in the run-up to an election because of the lags. We'd like a strong economy and the costs of that, more jobs now, inflation down the road. And so what lies at the heart, I think, of delegating to unelected officials is that there's a problem of making credible promises where the promise concerns the objective. But a precondition for that, if we're going to delegate to unelected officials, there needs to be some kind of consensus across the society, across the political community, on what the objective is. I think the important thing about central banking is more or less all wings of politics agree that low and stable inflation is a good idea. And those that don't are either on the revolutionary right or the revolutionary left, as Lenin kind of understood more than a century ago. And then if you go to other fields, take the environment. I'm not sure this is true in Europe, but in the United States, there just isn't that political consensus. The American people on the whole, as a collective, still want this to be a realm of political choice rather than we know what we want to do. We can't be sure to stick to what we want to do. We better hand over this mandate, but with a clear objective to unelected officials. The other thing I'll slip in now in response to your first question is, but you should never delegate choices about the distribution of resources. You could pre-program that.
Right.
As a Congress or Parliament and delegate it. But having people like me sit around and say, should we make the South better off today or the West or old people or young people? You know, hell, we elect people to make those choices. We don't appoint them.
Right. Well, how did we get here? Because you note in the book that the notion of politically insulated agencies are not antithetical to the vision of the U.S. founding fathers. You said in the book that in the U.S., some find delegation to agencies deeply troubling and arguably unconstitutional, but in many respects, it is entirely in the spirit of the founding fathers. I certainly agree with that, but I guess what was it about the 20th century in particular that caused policy delegation to spread so pervasively?
Well, let me start off first of all with an element of the vision of the founding fathers, not only the founding fathers, this is in Montesquieu and others in Europe, which I think is consistent with delegation. And that's the idea of fragmenting power so that power isn't held in one place. That's the separate legislature, executive, judiciary. But now imagine that the executive branch has the money printing power, unconstrained by the gold standard or anything like that. They don't really need Congress anymore. Mr. Trump can have his wall. I'm not arguing for the wall or against the wall. Mr. Trump can have his wall because the Federal Reserve will print the money to make it, and it's good sure. money that will pay for the costs. So I think the last people that should have the money power are the executive branch of government, because monetary policy is always latently an instrument of taxation. And yet you can't keep it easily within the legislature without some committee of the legislature becoming all powerful in that realm and marginalizing the rest of the legislature. And they would have no time to do anything else. It's a full-time job. So the challenge, I think, is to delegate it to central banks, but constrain them that they don't become a kind of rival fiscal authority. We'll come back to that. What happened in the 20th century? I think there's a different story for the United States and for Europe. Let me concentrate on the US one. In the middle of the century, really the first third, there was an expansion in the role of the state. And I think people were just careless, frankly, about, I don't think they needed to be. I mean, even for a while, there was that people argued that the idea of the separation of powers was redundant. And instead, you needed agencies that would be, that would make the laws and enforce the laws and reach adjudicatory judgments on the laws. And there needed to be a new kind of separation between fields. This is the argument of Landis. I think it's a terrible argument, essentially for the reasons I've already said about expertise. But I think in the middle of the century, and actually up to today, the US has kind of been careless about when to delegate power, in particular by delegating without very precise objectives.
Right.
And so then the delegee, if that's the right way of saying it, they'd kind of decide precisely what to do. If Congress hands over the problem, go forth and solve this problem, that's Congress abdicating or handing over power to the court who fills in the gaps or to an agency. And I don't think that was necessary, but I think that's where the problems began in the middle of the 20th century. I think they were avoidable and can still be remedied somewhat.
Continuing on this a little bit, you say in the book that the proliferation of independent agencies throughout the advanced economies over recent decades is an issue. Where specifically do you find that too much power has been delegated?
The let me first of all say there are some countries that have been pretty careful about this. France, somewhat to my surprise, which revealed a prejudice, I guess, that I wasn't aware of. France had a review of all of this about 20 years ago now, and they have reduced the number of independent agencies and have tighter criteria about when to delegate. In the United States, I'm going to call on two different types of example. The court has remedied this a bit, but the Consumer Finance Protection Board, multiple objectives, all vague, one policymaker, president can't get out of bed and sack the head. That's what the court has somewhat changed. And this kind of sins on a number of fronts, in that I've already said in passing, or implied in passing, you shouldn't be delegating without a reasonably precise objective. And actually, I think the test of that is that we can monitor it. Well, if you've got three equally ranking objectives, that's very hard. Another criterion would be avoid concentrated power. One woman or one man is delegated all of this power. We have you have a number of justices on a Supreme Court. You do, we do, Germany does, everybody does. Only one head of the consumer body. But then at the other end of the spectrum, if you take the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Commodities and Derivatives body, the CFTC, in some respects, they're not independent enough for some of their functions.
Right.
But they're also in the financial stability business, other things as well. but they are partly responsible for the stability of the financial system. And yet each year they have to go to Congress for appropriations for their budget to be funded. And Congress, although Congress finds it difficult to pass ordinary laws, each year it passes a list of prescriptions and proscriptions for agencies. And so the SEC and CFTC are constantly sensitive to the ebb and flow of opinion in Congress. I think that's fine for some of their functions, but for their role in preserving financial stability, I think I'd carve that out somehow and make them more independent for those purposes. And I think this just is another way of saying not enough thought has been given to how to design agencies. The antitrust agency, you can make a very good case for having antitrust independent, but actually it too is subject to annual appropriations, which is one of the reasons why so much goes on via the Department of Justice in the courts. And it's not obvious to me that the courts are a good place to make antitrust policy. People make a great fuss in the United States about how the law schools turn out great antitrust people. I mean, it's not at all obvious to me that that's right. I mean, it's certainly something that lots of people are committed to believing.
Right.
But it's not an accident that the trendsetter in antitrust is the European Commission.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, when I was reading your book, I kept thinking of what Milton Friedman famously said about monetary policy when he said, every now and then a reporter asked my opinion about current monetary policy, and my standard reply has become that I would be glad to answer if they would first tell me what current monetary policy is. And you talk in the book about how politically insulated agencies can often reach the boundaries of their mandate, either an explicitly defined mandate or one that has become socially acceptable, and how that can present problems, because in some instances, if those agencies were to step beyond their established remit, as the Treasury and Fed did in 2008 with the big banks, they could help prevent a crisis that would have been, you know, far more detrimental. But some legal scholars contend that what the Fed did and its deployment and interpretation of Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act was illegal. Those actions and the Treasury's actions to guarantee losses, future losses for the guarantee against future losses for the big banks, those actions helped save the economy from ruin. So in your view, should agencies have, you know, strictly defined mandates, or should some agencies have greater autonomy to, I guess, define their own domain given particular circumstance?
Let me start with Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman was a very great man. And what he said may have been correct when he said it, but it doesn't need to be correct. I mean, first of all, in a kind of short-term sense, what's the stance of monetary policy? The key test is, well, is monetary policy bearing down on demand, or is it stimulating demand?
Right.
Or keeping inflation down? That's a question on which views can differ, but it's a well-defined question on which one can reach a view. The second and more important thing is, and I think this may have been what he was getting at, is, so what's the strategy? What's the implicit rule, as some people would like to put it, that the central bank is following? And one of the principles I advance in my book is that central banks or any independent agency are obviously granted some discretion, constrained discretion, but they ought to publish their operating principles for how they're going to exercise that discretion. In monetary economics, people call that the reaction function. And it can never be completely precise, but it can be, nor does it need to be completely woolly. I mean, you can stand accountable for it. The main burden of your question, though, is just gigantic, which is, can it ever be right for unelected officials to go beyond their powers in order to save the world, which is what some scholars have said about the Federal Reserve? And I think the answer is that there's a kind of difficult, they have to separate this into well, what might be feasible for the president and for therefore for the U.S. Treasury, because they will be facing election.
Right.
And what is correct for the Federal Reserve, who will not be facing an election. And I think that central banks and other agencies, they should be staying within their powers. That the edges of those powers are always going to be blurred, and there can be reasonable differences of opinion about that. But furthermore, that even when they're clearly within their powers, technically, but they're going to do something that no one had ever, it had never occurred to anybody that they could do that. Then I think you need to go to the elected executive branch, and if you can, to Parliament, Congress, and say, this is within our powers. We're thinking of doing it for the following reasons. You know, if you think this is outrageous, you better stay so. But then you will have to cure it. And you kind of pass that. It isn't buck passing. It's saying, well, then it rests on your desk, not on ours. I think for the elected executive, it's a bit different, because of course they should stay within the law. But on the other hand, there is this check of accountability via elections that exists for them that isn't the case for unelected agencies. So I would apply a stricter standard for unelected agencies. And of course, that feeds back into, well, then you ought to be very careful about how you frame their powers and functions and objectives. I mean, I'm trying to, if you like, search for an incentive-compatible hole where people realize that it matters what the objectives are, that they can't just save the world irrespective of what their powers and objectives are. Now, this meets with quite a lot of skepticism among some people in the States. They'll say, don't be crazy. When the world's falling apart, the unelected agencies just sometimes are the only people that can act. And I think that's kind of to give up the most precious thing in our societies, which is representative democracy and the rule of law.
Right. Right. You know, with regard to central banking, I have sympathy for those who argue that our central banks have become too powerful, but you know, I blame that not on their desire to hold more power, but rather what I like to call, I guess, fiscal lethargy on the part of legislators and their desire not to be held accountable for any instance of economic malaise. And in the conclusion of Unelected Power, you offer a quote by Mervyn King where he says, central bank governors require three qualities above all: a deep commitment to price stability, an ability to be clear and direct to politicians about the policies that are required to produce economic stability, and the ability to be unpopular when circumstances require. And I think that last piece is where problems arise. You know, if elected officials were responsible for central bank functions, they wouldn't have the stomach to stick with it if doing so would threaten their ability to hold office. So I think the current central banking construct, at least here in the U.S., while under constant threat of greater congressional intervention, it actually works rather well for our elected officials because they can pin the blame on the central bank when things go wrong and take credit when things go right. So would you agree that this is sort of a fair assessment? And do you think that argument applies to most of the central bank treasury relationships of the developed world, that, it sort of works well for them?
If I'm allowed only one word as an answer, the answer is yes. But I'm gonna paint a slightly more complicated picture. First of all, the bit that's yes. Imagine that something really terrible happens in the economy, and you're the Treasury Secretary, and I'm the Fed Chair or the Central Bank Governor, and I come to see you, and we agree that the best response is for a mixture of fiscal action and monetary action. And you know, all things considered, given all the things that we care about, including not fueling bubbles in the housing market and asset markets and so on and so forth, I leave the room. We've just done some economic policy making. And your political advisors are sitting with you, and they're really agitated. And they say, but look, this is you're going to have to carry the cabinet, and you're going to have to carry the donors and the base, and depending on the political system, you know, some marginal members in Congress. But the same concerns play out everywhere, and they really bang on about this. Essentially, short-term political costs of, let's say, doing the right thing. And so you say, but you know, I've the economics points to spreading the burden, and you say to them, but I get the political costs. What happens if I don't do anything? And they say, oh, he'll do more. And this is what the language of games is somewhat important, somewhat unfortunate, because it certainly doesn't imply frivolity. But in the language of game theory, this is a sequential game or a Stackelberg game where the fiscal authority moves first. And if the fiscal authority sits on its hands, the central bank has no option but to use what powers it properly has to pursue its legal mandate. In the euro area crisis, Mario Draghi was constantly framing what he did in terms of their legal their mandate. And this is just an analytical way of making your point that the elected politicians have incentives to avoid doing things that will be unpopular with somebody or other, in this example, their base, in the short run. And so we instead have all the costs of over-reliance on central banking. The qualification I want to add is, and I think this has crept into central banking over the past 5 or 6 years, is when central bankers think that they can accrue public prestige from pursuing things that aren't actually central to their mandate, social justice, climate change, things that actually matter more in some respects than price stability. But for me, the difficulty when they do that is it blunts their incentives to do the thing that only they can do. If I think that my prestige for being a climate warrior is going to survive even mistakes on monetary policy, I've got weakened incentives to do the right thing and be unpopular in the short run on monetary policy. And then that shades into something else, which is, and this is the bigger point actually, which is, I think to some extent, what in Britain we call the political classes, but the example isn't particularly about Britain, have kind of decoded the central banking game. And they've realized what if we have central bank leaders, not just chairs, but the others, who look like the real thing, but actually are sensitive to our wishes, well, actually, that might be very helpful. And I think that politicians ended up concluding after the, I didn't notice this at the time, by the way. I think after the last financial crisis, politicians, it was as though they inferred, they never said out loud, but it was as though they inferred, this business of keeping inflation low, it's easier than these central bankers say. So actually, we don't need to appoint the reincarnation of Paul Volcker to these positions. And then, and this was more evident, they've demonstrated through this crisis that they can steer credit to different parts of the economy to keep the financial system and the economy alive Well, if they can steer credit, they can do it for all sorts of other reasons. They could steer it to regions that are struggling. They could steer it to sectors that need a bit more support to be dynamic and improve productivity growth. We need some central bankers that are going to be up for that. And so in the United States, you see this manifest, I think, in talk of inclusive growth. Inclusive growth is a very good thing. Don't get me wrong. But actually, the Federal Reserve would do quite well just to ensure the path of aggregate demand is in line with the path of aggregate supply and inflation is in line with their target. And then go home each day.
Right.
But it's good for politicians. I don't think they're just shedding blame now. I think that they've kind of transferred some responsibilities. I'll close on this in a second. More in continental Europe than in the US. You have, well, the politicians aren't doing anything on climate change, but the European Central Bank, it can steer credit away from polluters. And in a sense, that's true. But that's a form of taxation. And I want to say, going back, almost 1,000 years, my country at least likes to elect the people that decide taxation. And I strongly recommend everybody else takes that approach too.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Continuing on, I guess, the only game in town narrative, probably my favorite part of your book was when you clarified that with regard to central banks becoming the only game in town, this wasn't because they themselves volunteered. It was that central banks were volunteered by the various governments to which they reported. You say, even in countries with solid public finances, and even when standard monetary policy reached the effective lower bound for short-term nominal interest rates, politicians declined to provide sustained discretionary short-term fiscal stimulus in the years after the worst of the great financial crisis. And this, and in doing so, in effect, this forced central banks to step in and pick up the slack. Do you think that this happened, this being that central banks have expanded their domain and in some sense have been forced beyond their explicit directives, because central banks have assumed the responsibilities that have been neglected, or because central banks have in fact been delegated their responsibility? I guess what I'm trying to ask is, did politicians deliberately assign central banks the power to intervene, or did politicians just merely sit on their hands when action needed to be taken, or are they one and the same?
I think both. And so in terms of what we're talking about at a high level, one and the same. In Britain, there was fiscal retrenchment, what became known as austerity, combined with the Monetary Policy Authority just continuing to stimulate in every way possible. Credit markets, government bond markets, super low interest rates with commitments to keep them low forever. In the United States, it was less austerity than not providing the fiscal stimulus that they might have done. I mean, there's a great argument that will go on forever, as you know, about should the Obama administration have provided more fiscal stimulus. But, the key point in that debate always is that the Obama administration didn't think they would get it through Congress.
Right.
Well, whether consciously or not, that was partly predicated on the basis, well, the Federal Reserve will do more. They'll keep the economy going. I think where central bankers could have been acted slightly differently, and it's easy for me to say this because I left office in late 2013, but by 2015-16, I'll explain those dates in a second, I think they could have been saying on both sides of the Atlantic, there's too much reliance on us. We have to carry on doing this if they do nothing, but this isn't good for the economy. We have a flat yield curve rather than an upward sloping yield curve that is fueling speculative fever in financial markets, for which we might pay a price one day. It's certainly pushing up asset prices. And so the rich are getting even richer. The asset rich are getting richer relative to people without savings. And they could have said, you know, and what's more, whatever you think about that, actually up to a point we're pushing, we, the monetary people, are pushing against a string. We are not the best. We're the best people to tide an economy through a short-term hit. We're not the best people to get the economy through some kind of pervasive structural slump. Now, the reason I choose 15, 16 is that the euro area crisis wasn't over until 2012. And believe you me, I was in office during this period. People in Washington, including right at the center of Washington, were really, really worried about the implications of a euro area breakup for the American economy. And right. I think they were quite right to be so bothered. So although some people start saying, well, QE started, quantitative easing started in early 2009, surely they should have been bringing it to a halt by 2012-13. Actually, on both sides of the Atlantic, we were either actively dealing with the euro area crisis or kind of preparing to fend off the spillovers from the euro area crisis. But by 2015-16, that's no longer so. And I think, I actually believe that my next-door neighbor at work, Mervyn King, who you've mentioned already, who was the governor of the Bank of England, I think if he'd carried on a few more years, he would have made this point. But I think it's not that I want to criticize particular people. I think everyone had become habituated to the political people sit on their hands, the central bankers save the world.
Right.
And you know, it's really important that one holds on to, actually, it shouldn't just be us saving the world. Yes, when there's in an emergency, we can act a lot quicker than those fiscal people. But as time drags on, there are things that they can do that we can't do. And this could be budget neutral. It can be, you know, infrastructure spending financed by taxes, which if you're at the zero lower bound, that can still be net additive to spending in the economy. And what's more, if you direct the spending towards infrastructure and things, you improve the underlying strength of the economy. I mean, America is the richest country in the world with very poor public infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the next thing I was going to ask you. Do you think that the progression of only game in town outcomes has resulted in an underdevelopment or even outright abandonment of fiscal projects that not only provide high fiscal multipliers during economic downturns, but also provide for much needed capital investment? You know, you mentioned infrastructure. You know, has greater delegation to central banks for economic recovery stunted the much needed investments in the future of the state?
Yes. And not just the future of the state in the sense of the collective of the American people, not the state as in the sense of government in Washington.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's my country's got its own problems, but the people of America shouldn't feel terribly proud of your public infrastructure.
That's the truth.
I think one of the things that people haven't been prepared to do is to say, hold on, you know, we're in the 21st century. This will bridge to my other book in a way where we're not, you know, God hasn't given us a right to be the most important country in the world forever. We've got to get our act together.
Right.
And whether it's bridges on the Northeast coast or bits of the infrastructure elsewhere, there are things that could happen that would be worthwhile, and they could be tax funded. This would be a good thing to do. They don't have to be debt financed. But I think that fiscal passivity, a lot of people would say fiscal passivity is a product of the system of government, that you have to carry a lot of people to do everything. Of course, and politics has become even more fractious. Of course, all of that is true. But it's hard not to believe that it would be harder to do nothing if you didn't think, well, at least the Federal Reserve will keep the economy going.
Right.
And so there's a sense in which the Federal Reserve keeps the economy going, you know, risks blowing bubbles in the financial markets, that makes people very angry, and the infrastructure of the country deteriorates, which makes people angry.
Yeah.
And I think central bankers could say something about that. More strictly, I think that central bankers shouldn't be in the business of telling elected officials what to do, for God's sake. But they can say what they can't do. They can't make the economy more dynamic. They can't make the economy more fair. They can't raise the underlying rate of growth. And they could say all of these things, and they could say them with conviction, because that's the consensus. And there'll always be a few people out there that disagree, but that's the consensus. And I'm definitely part of that consensus.
Yeah, I mean, why do you think that there hasn't been a greater outcry with regard to this shift? Why do you think electorates have been so content with policymakers neglecting their fiscal duties in righting the economy?
What a great question. So maybe people have just got used to it.
Yeah.
You know, we get used to it. And then actually, well, of course, they won't do anything. But that's met with a kind of, combined with a kind of contempt for elected politicians. Well, we can't rely on them to do anything. And so that what's a habit becomes corrosive. But I think the central bankers could have taken the debate to the public in the kind of the way I've described. One of the things that we in London, those of us that were then at the Bank of England, were surprised about during the 07, 08, 09 crisis, was that the leaders of the Federal Reserve didn't go on television very much. Mm. And so their faces weren't familiar to the American people. Now, one shouldn't do it too much, because one shouldn't be competing with the politicians in their own space. So that you can definitely do too much, but you can definitely also do too little. And the Federal Reserve, I think, has tended to do too little. And the people in Washington have tended to rely too much on the regional feds around this great nation to spread their message. But actually, people need to see the face of the chair in Idaho and Utah and New Mexico and Louisiana and things. And you do that slowly and in a kind of, not in a dramatic way, so that people know you, and also so that you've got a platform to say, you know, people are relying on us too much. We can't, and then that litany I gave just now of things you can't do, and with the clear implication, perhaps unstated by the Fed chair, that other people could do this. Right. Plenty of commentators will come in and say that. I mean, it's one can never take on the politicians, but kind of, if you like, one can surround them with the argument.
Right.
As long as the argument is careful and clear.
You know, another point of your book that I thought was so important, and you've alluded to it a bit, is the notion of buying time. I think that we've come to believe that central bankers can fix any problem, economic or not. And I mean, we have central bankers being asked to do everything under the sun, assist with climate change. You mentioned it earlier. And I just think that that's very much a slippery slope. You said in the book that central banks can buy time, but they cannot enhance long-run prosperity. They can help the economy recover from disastrous recession, but cannot improve underlying growth dynamics. They can help bring spending forward, but cannot create more long-term wealth. Do you think that we really are asking too much of central bankers? And if so, how can the central banks themselves push back at the elected officials that just keep piling on further responsibilities and mandates?
Well, first of all, the list of things you've included, which is lender of last resort, liquidity and assistance can quell a panic. can sometimes put the economy back onto a decent path, and so it does rescue financial institutions. But sometimes a particular bank or non-bank is so fundamentally broken that liquidity assistance won't make any difference. It's just bust. There's no plausible state of the world in which it will be able to service its debts, and it needs to go into a bankruptcy procedure or into a resolution procedure where the equity holders and others lose their investment. And I think for all the things you've listed, and for that additional thing, the central bankers need to explain that. It's just a mistake for them to hold themselves out or allow themselves to be painted as the solution to all the problems. My goodness, you know, we've got big problems in the West. Underlying growth has been weak for a long time. This is really serious. If you imagine a world where there is zero per capita growth, everything is distributional. I can only be worse off if everybody else, I can only be better off if everybody else in aggregate is worse off.
Right.
You and I, you know, et cetera. And distributional politics are kind of fraught and sometimes toxic. And I think central bankers are absolutely within their rights talking about what a big issue this is and adding, but monetary policy can't solve it.
Right.
And, you know, we've got to put back on, nor can government solve it on its own, for goodness sake. I don't want to sit here and think, well, the fiscal policymakers have a magic wand, they can cure all ills. I mean, it's about harnessing and unleashing dynamism in the private sector, but government can help do that. Infrastructure spending that's well targeted can do that. And I think central bankers kind of need to be bothered, and what rather than feeling, I don't know how they feel, but flattered or celebrated that people regard them as capable of solving so many problems, it would be better if they felt distressed and paranoid about it. You know, it'd be quite a good thing if they could get inflation down without avoiding a really nasty recession. It would be quite a good thing if they could get, if they can't do both, then they've just got to get inflation down. They bridging to the next part of our discussion, the West absolutely cannot afford another massive financial crisis.
Right.
These are things they can do. I worked for a marvelous governor of the Bank of England called Eddie George, who was governor between 1993 and 2003. And he used to say, what we're for is stability, stability, stability. And if they get back to that, curiously, I think they would be criticized less if they did less, given that the core of their job is difficult.
Right.
And is vital.
Right. Well, Sir Tucker, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Thank you, Edward. Great to talk to you.
That's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with our very special guest, Sir Paul Tucker. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.